Are you in the process of creating something huge and you want to understand how others have done it? Or have you already found success and still feel something is missing? Then this podcast is for you. Welcome to the Alchemist Lounge, a podcast where Alex Atwood chats with top performers to discover habits, routines, and alchemy that you can put to work in your own life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Alchemist Lounge. I'm your host, Alex Atwood, and today we have a very special guest joining us, a very dear friend of mine. Her name is Heather Wagner, and she is a trauma-informed leadership coach, which means she has a ton of experience and knowledge helping individuals and organizations deal with trauma. So our conversation today is going to cover all sorts of topics. We're going to have incredibly valuable information going through critical skills required to recognize, navigate, and support others and yourself in coping with the effects of trauma. Excited to talk and get some teachings from Heather. Heather, it's a pleasure to have you in the lounge today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start things off. Tell me a little about your background and what inspired you to become a trauma-informed coach?
Oh, where to begin? So I'm going to answer that question in two different ways. So I have been doing transformational work for over 30 years. I am 45. I'm not afraid to say that out loud. but when people hear 30 years, they kind of, you know, raise an eyebrow to me. So at the time, diagnosed ADHD kid, but no one really knew what to do with that back then. And I also was undiagnosed sensory processing disorder, auditory processing disorder, lots of acronyms, HSP, autistic, lots of things. And essentially what that meant was I was the only straight A student who spent most of her time in school suspension because they didn't know what to do with me. and I was lucky enough to have a mentor in the school counselor. She saw that I really just needed a place to kind of channel my angst and energy. And so she got me involved in this theater group where we would go out into other schools and we would perform these improvisational skits to our peers around really big topics like rumors and drugs and suicide and divorce and all the things that kids kind of deal with. And so we would sit down in character afterwards and our peers would get to ask us these really complex conversation questions and we would answer in character. So I had no idea how that experience would inform my life's work, but I really learned at a young age how to hold space for really vulnerable, really transparent conversations that most kids in middle school are not holding. So that really, I found my purpose in that. I found that I'm really good at holding space. And so that kind of brought me into this work in general and just really being in the inquiry and working also, you know, that background in improvisational theater, you're really working in the emergent space, in that liminal space. And so I got exposed to that kind of work at a really young age and it just kind of unfolded over the course of 30 years. And I've done everything from being a sex educator to, you know, doing big, deep transformational work, which is some of the spaces you and I have been in. And, you know, I eventually found my way into more traditional coaching. I attended an ICF accredited coach training school. And over the years, I started to do my own trauma work and unpack my own experiences because I did come from a very colorful childhood. And I started to become this coach that was getting referred to organizations that had dysfunctional teams or to leaders who were considered like, you know, the difficult leaders or difficult managers. And as I started to work closer and closer with these people, I really started to understand, like, this is just trauma manifested in our organizational spaces. And so it brought me into learning how to go deeper. I ended up in seminary for a little while, which was a hugely transformational experience. I did a collective trauma certification with Thomas Hubble, who's an amazing leader in the collective trauma space. I'm a consumer of content, so I've taken lots of classes, and I'm also writing a book now on trauma-informed leadership. What I found was going into these organizations and working with people, it's not about training people in like how to communicate better. I mean, yes, those skills are important, but really it's teaching the core skills of like compassion and empathy, which if you can't access those things for yourself, you can't access for others. And the only way to access it for yourself is to start to do that deep inner work. So that's how I kind of ended up in that space. The reason I decided to become a trauma-informed coach and to teach other coaches and transformational professionals about this work is because I saw a problem in transformational spaces where unknowingly coaches and facilitators were gaslighting, re-triggering, re-traumatizing folks. You know, that old model of transformation of like drive people's stuff up so that it's there and for them to deal with. It was actually not. Science shows that that actually did a lot more damage than it did good. And it's not to say that some people love that model and it works for them. But when you look at the nervous system and you understand where does the actual growth and integration happen, it doesn't happen in a high gradient, highly traumatizing space. Mm-hmm. So that's the really long-winded answer to how I got into this intersection and why I'm so passionate about it.
Wow, that's fascinating. You know, I find it particularly fascinating. You mentioned the term holding the space on in an early age, which was an improvisational theater that was done for, you said, middle school kids who were going through all of the turbulence of moving from childhood into adulthood and all of that. And yeah. So early on, you created a space, a connection, a vehicle in which to give this information that these kids would resonate with and maybe feel entertained a bit and activated in there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I didn't do this particular skit. I still have it memorized though. It's a poem. I'm probably going to get emotional thinking about it, actually. It was a poem. One of my peers sat on a stool and recited this poem. And it was really intense, especially to be in a group of your peers, because it was all about suicide. And we might need to put trigger warnings on this podcast, by the way. Yeah. But, you know, in a very solemn, very present space, you know, she just started with once on a yellow paper with green lines, I wrote a poem and I called it Chops because that was the name of the dog and that's what it was all about. I'm going to get emotional. And so you go through the poem and it starts from this really happy childhood place and it ends up with the author committing suicide. It's a really famous poem, but to have a 10-year-old on stage reciting that and to have all of our peers then unpack that together and what it brings up for us and to hold space for and safety for people to do that amongst peers was like a life-changing experience for me and really taught me what it meant to create safety and hold space for others.
Yeah. And really informs trauma from an early age.
100%.
I get that. So for those in our audience who may be new to the concept, how would you define trauma-informed leadership?
Well, I think the first thing I want to do is kind of just break out trauma for a second because, you know, there's a lot of still bias and stigma and misunderstanding about what trauma is. People still conflate trauma with the event. And really, that's part of I consider myself more a trauma educator at the end of the day because I'm teaching people so much around the somatics, the neurology, the neuroscience, the neurobiology of trauma. I equate it to like trauma response is what the nervous system does to digest life. And sometimes we can't digest all of it. Like we bite off more than we can chew. And so trauma response is that anything that pushes us out of our window of tolerance, too much, too fast, too soon, not enough, having our agency taken away, oppression, there's lots of triggers that cause trauma response. chronic stress. We talked about the hospitality industry. I can go on down that path in a second, but trauma is actually the nervous system's response to whether or not we can digest what we're experiencing in our life. And everyone experiences it different. So there's the event, whatever that was. Then there's our experience of that event, which is very subjective. And then there's the long-term impacts of that experience. Some of it we're able to digest and move through fairly quickly, and other things have lifelong impacts depending on the experience, the person, and what the effects were, right? So I think it's first understanding that trauma is not the event. It's the experience you have of the event. I think what we're seeing more and more these days, you know, we went through the collective trauma of COVID. There are certain industries that are just higher trauma industries, like the hospitality industry, where you're on all the time and your nervous system is constantly processing. I love the restaurant industry because there's something about that adrenaline and, you know, being in that that's so exhilarating. But the tax it actually plays on your nervous system and your overall being is largely misunderstood and underplayed. So I think, you know, that's what leads to a lot of the depression and mental health meltdowns. And that whole industry is really attractive to people who also have high resiliency and high trauma histories, right? So it's like this complex space to be in. But even in our organizations, in our capitalist culture, which I am not here to debate or that here, but there's real effects to like having to be on all the time, 60, 70, 80 hour work weeks. We only have 2 weeks off a year. Like that culture of high productivity and our value is tied to our productivity. That's a traumatizing environment to live in all of the time. And people kind of don't realize that until they have mental or physical well-being breakdowns. And they're like, oh, chronic stress, you know, traumatized me.
Yeah. So why is being a trauma-informed leader particularly relevant to people in business, coaches, CEOs, hospitality leaders, healthcare leaders? Why is that relevant these days? Or why is that relevant ever, I should say?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of like debate around linguistics and semantics with the word. You know, for a long time, it was like, I think there was even laws, to be honest with you, around like only a therapist or a clinician could ever use the word trauma. I think that's even what the law still might be, but it's not necessarily being enforced at the end of the day. And I was like, that's just so weird to me. It would be like, oh, only dietitians can say the word digestion. Like, I'm sorry. That's so weird. But why it's relevant and important is because everyone has trauma. There's a variety of ways we inherit and experience trauma. The question isn't, do I or have I experienced trauma? It's like, do I digest food or don't I digest food? It's how much trauma have I experienced? How much is still undigested in my body and my nervous system? And how is it impacting our systems, my system, everywhere? So I think the trauma space really, and this, when I did this research for my course, I was like, my mind was like, they didn't even have PTSD in the DSM, the diagnostic manual that clinicians use, until like the late 19, I can't remember the exact date, but it was like, I was like 17. I already was well traumatized by the time the mental health field was like, oh, this trauma thing is real and we need to actually have a diagnosis around it. So the trauma space is only about 20 years old as we know it now, really. It's so young and emergent. So I think the reason why it's important for leaders to know now is at the end of the day, it's in your cultures, like things that people call toxic work culture is actually trauma manifesting in our cultural systems. Things that people call toxic behavior is actually trauma being projected. We want to make these big moves towards being mentally, focusing on employee mental health and employee well-being, which is great in theory, but if your operations and your systems are not set up in a way where people can actually live that in execution. If you have traumatizing organizational systems, doesn't matter how many wellness benefits you offer, you're still traumatizing your people. And so I tell people, like, I don't expect you as a coach or as a leader that you're now a clinician or it's your job to treat people or even process stuff. But it is your job to have at least an understanding of this invisible force that is 1000% impacting your business. Like startup culture, for example. In startup culture, we have few bodies, few resources. We're operating on this, like, we have to fundraise. Doing that for a year will completely rewire your nervous system and your perspective to be in constant fight or flight, which impacts your decision making, which impacts your resilience to even keep going in your company, which impacts your decision making. Like, the quick science is like the prefrontal cortex, all of that higher level good decision making happens in the front part of the brain. When you're in fight or flight and when you're living in that constant state of dysregulation and trauma response, only the survival part of your brain is actually operating. So do you want to be making business decisions from survival, or do you want to be making business decisions from like a really higher level, strategic, well thought out place? So it's everywhere. And I think, you know, it's emerging more and more as something we should be aware of as leaders.
That's so informative. I can already tell that leaders and CEOs and people in a position to actually set up support systems for their teams will be curious as to, you know, what are some common signs that someone, you know, in a professional environment or an organizational environment could be dealing with the effects of trauma. So how is that? How could a leader like find common signs and then be able to take action and then support them?
Well, I mean, some of the signs are overt and some of them are covert, right? I think the more overt signs are your bleeding talent. Your exit interviews are like, there's no work-life balance. I feel under-supported. You know, I always used to say in my early consulting days, like, and I didn't make this up, but I heard it somewhere, like, people don't quit companies, they quit managers. So if you have a manager that's, you know, their management style is driving people out of the organization, providing them with not just like, oh, here's your like soft skills training, like look at how to provide them with deeper level of transformational work if they are open to it. You know, I think when you build your value, if well-being is a value of yours, making sure that things like workflows are sustainable. I see a lot of people like give out, for example, unlimited PTO, but then there's like this guilt or pressure not to take any PTO. So it's like, create and model at the leadership level, create and model well-being, take time off, be very proactive about that, constantly take feedback, you know, do surveys and listen to what the people are telling you. But if their workflow is too high, if they feel like they can't take a break, if they feel under-supported, if toxic behavior, which I don't even like to use that word anymore, so I got to get it out of my own lexicon. If poor management styles, which are related to an individual's trauma, cannot be enabled long-term because it will impact the organization, you know, is your onboarding set up to where people feel safe and have everything they need to feel, you know, set up for success? What is the psychological safety inside your organization? Because at the end of the day, I say psychological safety starts in the nervous system. Because that's where safety begins. So if I can't be in a regulated space, it doesn't matter how many DEI workshops you do. If I don't feel safe in my body to be there, then it doesn't matter. So, you know, I think you have to kind of take the feedback, look at your systems, make sure you're integrating the well-being values in execution. Those are some simple ways to manage.
Yeah. And having an environment that allows for transparency, it sounds like.
Transparency. Important. Absolutely. Yeah. So trauma-informed work actually started in the 1990s. I can't remember the exact date when it's SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Department of the National of the U.S. Department of Health was created because they recognized that people working in mental health spaces, specifically in substance abuse and social work, that there was a lot of vicarious trauma that employees and counselors and therapists were picking up from working in marginalized spaces where there was a lot of trauma. So the whole body of trauma-informed work started there. From there, it started to move into, okay, if you want to do business with the government, you have to then be a trauma-informed workplace. So they started to move into that sector. And now private organizations and private sector is starting to be like, especially post-COVID and with this new mental health focus because of everything that's gone on the last few years, they're starting to go like, okay, what is this trauma-informed thing and how can we integrate it? So there's organizations and consultants that really focus on helping you do this if this is something you're interested in.
So let's unpack that. If you're a leader, and I've read a lot in your work about how you talk about the importance of self-care for leaders.
Yeah.
It starts with you. It starts with you.
100% starts with you.
Right. So can you share some tips or some strategies that our listeners can use to better manage their own stress and trauma, particularly in like high pressure environments?
Yeah. I have this like holistic assessment that I do with folks, and it's like, it's a little bit coachy in the sense of it's like a whole life. Like, let's look at the whole, like the life wheel. If you're a coach, you work in the coaching space, you've like seen a life wheel where you rate every area of your life. But I put a little bit different twist on it rather than like, how much do you like enjoy or love or what would you rate it? I actually have people say, how supported are you in this area? And we're looking at everything from like, you know, like how resourced are you is the term. Do you have good supportive childcare? Do you have community? How is your emotional well-being? Are you in therapy or do you have therapeutic modalities that work for you? Because I'm pro-talk therapy, but it's not the be-all end all. There's a lot of modalities out there. And I'm more pro-somatic modalities, especially for trauma, but that could be yoga, dance. Like there's lots of ways, but how supported do you feel physically? How supportive do you feel emotionally? How supported are you financially? How strong is your marriage? How supported are your children? What's your home life like? Do you love your home? Do you feel supported by your home? Because if you start to look at everything from how supported am I, the more resourced and the more supported you are, the more regulated you can be, the more grounded you can be, the more present you can be. And there's very particular tools I teach. I made up this thing called PASI, which it stands for presence, where you kind of like do an exercise to really ground yourself and get present. The A stands for attunement and really like attuning into what's going on for you and getting into that internal landscape. And then regulation or co-regulation is what the C stands for PASI. And then I is information integration. And this particular tool I made up is both an exercise you can walk through, but these are competencies that you can develop. Like these are like any other skill, like the skill of presencing is, you know, whether you use mindfulness work or whatever you use to practice presencing. So learning the tools to help you regulate is another way. Assessing your life and making sure you're fully supported. And if you're not, focusing on getting yourself supported. Learning how to integrate as you're learning about yourself and healing, and how do I apply these insights into my life? Because insights are great, but if you don't put them into action, then it doesn't matter. So like those are the two things: resource yourself and learn to do the inner work. And then when you can do those things, you can support your people, your children, your husband, your partner better, because you know how to be grounded. You know how to process trauma and support yourself, so you can then support your teams and other people. But you have to be resourced and you have to have these competencies in order to do it.
So leaders should invest in modalities for themselves and whatever works for them. And and these days, there's so many different options in terms of leadership, transformational coaching, There's almost too many options these days, and they may not know where to go. And what I would say, it starts with simple practices that you can adopt that work for you and that you can commit to, most importantly.
Yeah.
Because those commitments really pay off.
Yeah.
And then working with someone like yourself or, you know, all sorts of leadership transformational coaches that are out there that can help support whatever rituals you put in place and help achieve those goals.
I have a little hack I'll offer. I learned it from a therapist who helped me actually write the curriculum for my program. But I use this, it's called SIFT. It stands for senses, images, feelings, and thoughts, right? So it actually comes from Dan Siegel. It's this exercise where you kind of work through things. But what I was taught is each of us has a different channel that's more open. So if you have a lot of sensations, you're a kinesthetic processor, for example, finding body-based modalities is probably for you.
Yeah.
If you're an image person and you get a lot of visuals and that's the channel that's open for you, doing like art therapy or like more creative endeavors to kind of process and find your grounding is what's right for you. Feelings could be, if you're an external processor, talk therapy is great. CBT is great. Again, dance and art is great. Some of these overlap, but they hit all of them. And then if you're an internal processor, writing might be a good way for you to process your emotions because you don't have to do it with somebody else. It's more internal. Music might be a way for you to process what's going on internally if feelings are more your channel. And then the last one, thoughts. That's where like CBT, DBT, that more traditional talk therapy. But again, writing is great for that as well. So getting in tune with which way you process is really helpful for picking a modality.
Yeah. So take the time to pay attention to what it is that works for you.
And try them all until one really hits. I think people ask me all the time, like, what do I do for this? I'm like, well, what have you tried?
You know, this is such valuable information. I'll tell you, in the HR space specifically.
Yeah.
Right. And I work with a lot of HR management, HR leadership. Sometimes there's misconceptions around the word trauma, trauma-informed. This sort of line is sort of drawn where, you know, how personal do HR leaders want their, you know, managers, their leaders among departments to be with their staff or with their teams. So HR specifically, because HR, you know, Are there misconceptions that we could start to use language or you know things that resonate with human resources folks who are actually in charge of this stuff?
Yeah, so I'm currently in a director of people operations role in a trauma-informed organization. I definitely have one foot on the compliance side and one foot on the what I call the humanity side. I think that, you know, you hear these terms, these buzzwords in the HR space, like future of work and people-centered and all this other stuff. And I think as organizational culture has grown and adapted, you know, I think I heard Simon Sinek talking about this. There's a great podcast that's got Brené Brown, Simon Sinek, and Adam Grant. The three of them are just kind of doing what we're doing right now, but about what's going on in the space. It's great. But they talked about how like in the late 80s, it was really about people were just things to keep control over, make sure they're doing their job, work them until you can get everything out of them. It was kind of that model of HR. And I think with this new generation that we're managing who has much stronger values and boundaries around well-being, I think as a lot of automation and tech has replaced some of the more functional work, we just have people doing jobs. So in those spaces, we have to now bring that more people-oriented, keep them engaged kind of model of HR. You can't just do compliance. Like, yes, you do, because that's a huge part of what keeps the business open and ticking. But you have to start to embrace that we aren't just machines having output. And if you're stuck there in your own beliefs around HR, I invite you to hire a coach or start to unpack those beliefs. Not because they're wrong. I just think they're dated is at the end of the day. They're dated. So here's what I tell people. Trauma is in the space, whether you name it or not. So if you want to keep functioning and put your blinders on, your ability to actually have impact becomes very limited because you're not addressing things with the full scope of what's happening. So for example, I'm in meetings all the time, employee relations meetings, where I have my HR hat on around what's the compliance, what's the policy, and are we following it? Then I have my hat on of what are our core values? Are we living from those values in this conversation? And then I have the hat on is what is going on for this employee holistically that may or may not be contributing to the issues we're seeing with this person. And that is a trauma-informed perspective. You can see the whole of the picture and how it's impacted. I don't have to be this person's therapist. But if I have a irate, angry, triggered employee in my space and I'm just throwing policies at them, we aren't really going to get anywhere. But if I'm starting with a wellness check and genuine concern and hearing and validating, go all the way back to that 10-year-old who was on stage with a bunch of middle schoolers. If I'm holding space and I'm hearing and I'm validating and I know that a triggered, activated body needs a calm, regulated, empathic space to regulate, I can help this person regulate. I can help them process what they need. I can point them back to our policies and protocols in a very compassionate way. And then I can follow up with them and make sure they're doing their, they got what they needed. And I'm just bringing that kind of customer service model to it. So like trauma-informed does not have to be you're a space for therapy now or you are responsible. I have a whole chapter in my book called It's Not My Job where I break this down and I'm like, it is your job to be human-centered as a people team. It's not your job to go unpack all of their stuff in their history. That is not your job. But understanding where those boundaries are.
Yes, I love that. So setting up the conditions for fertile conversation is
love
beautiful.
That.
I love that. I absolutely love that. So much great information. HR department leaders will get so much from this conversation.
I hope.
So if our listeners could take away just one key lesson from our conversation today to help them become better trauma-informed leaders, what would you want that to be?
The four R's that come from that SAMHSA, I talked about that before, the substance abuse, mental health. The four R's are recognize that everyone has experienced some level of trauma in their life, whether they're aware of it or not. The second R is to respond so that you're responding in a compassionate way. Resist re-traumatizing the person. So don't shame them, blame them, make them wrong. Just be an empathetic space. And I forgot the fourth R. But at the end of the day, this is my neurodivergent ADHD brain, everyone, and I'm not afraid to admit it. I think the biggest key takeaway is just acknowledging that whatever this human being has them activated, it doesn't matter what. It's just that they are, and you can hold space for that, and you can be a compassionate human, and you can help them figure out what they need. I think a lot of people tend to come right with the policy, the discipline, the correction, the compliance, and you know, just being a compassionate, open space. It makes you trauma-informed right out the gate. How's that?
I love it. And compassion in action is what that sounds like.
It is.
Yeah. There's a lot of vernacular in the leadership space about servant leadership and empathy and vulnerability. And those are all wonderful words, and seeing them in action and hearing about what it looks like in action actually has an impact in it. And I hope that it resonates with our audience. I'm sure, I know it resonated with me. So those who are interested in reading your book, getting in contact with you, how would they do that?
The best way to reach me, by the way, I just have to correct this. It's realization, recognizing, recognizing that they're triggered and they're having a response, responding and resisting re-traumatization. It was the recognizing, I forgot. Okay.
We got the acronym.
We did. The best way to reach me is probably through LinkedIn. I'm on there as Rev Heather Lynn Wagner. So if you search that, I am currently in revisions of the book, but you can find links for the pre-sale page. Little plug, my husband, who's an award-winning chef, you might want to know about this, Alex. We're doing an author's dinner here in DC. It's going to be a pop-up throwback of the restaurant we used to own in Florida. So we're really excited about that. It'll be in the fall, date to be determined. And then I'm really reachable. You know, if you ever want a consult or just have a conversation or you want resources, you can find me at heatherlynnwagner.com as well. So yeah.
Got it. Just Google Heather Lynn Wagner. You'll pull up her website and you'll see all sorts of interesting and insightful information around trauma-informed leadership. Thank you so much for this conversation today. It covered so many topics, so much incredibly useful information. And we'll definitely look forward to having you back on to talk a little bit more about hospitality and learn a little bit more about how those that industry can better deal with conflict in the kitchen.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening in to The Alchemist Lounge. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review on Apple iTunes. To catch all the latest from Alex Atwood, you can check out his website at alexatwood.co. Thanks again, and we'll catch you next time at The Alchemist Lounge.